Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lincoln on Lending, David Lincoln.
Good to be with you, everybody. It is Monday, July 18th. Hard to believe we're racing through the summer months, but we are, and it's good to be with us. Appreciate you, and I just really want to say thank you to all the listeners that make this one of their ways in which they stay on top of all of what's going on in the industry. This broadcast was, again, created by mortgage professionals for mortgage professionals, and we're the proud recipient of the Innovation Award from Progress in Lending. So thank you to everyone there. I want to say a special thank you to Logan Motoshami, who will be joining us in the Hot Topic segment. Any of you that have listened to this program on a regular basis, you know who Logan is. We'll be talking about housing, giving a housing update. We're going to be talking we're going to debunk some of these theories. We're going to talk about bears that have been out there, the perma bears, as Logan refers to them, why they've been wrong, why has their focus been off? Is it really the Fed? It's just a lot of great information. So as I was saying just before the program started, one of the things I like about, people, I like being around humble people, and Andy Schell and Logan have this in common. They're wicked smart, and they have a way of challenging authority. And they're not afraid to buck and stand up and respectfully. That's the key word here. They respectfully buck and conventional wisdom. And I love how they do it. So we've invited Logan to come back and talk about the housing market. Very excited to have him on and have him share his comments. So we're looking forward to having Logan Motoshami join us again. I've been looking forward to this segment for some time. Always preparing for these segments is, sometimes you're learning things, and then sometimes you're just getting excited because it confirms things you already know, and that's the case with Logan. Logan, first of all, thank you so much for rejoining us on the broadcast here. We've had you on, and we always have a loyal set of followers. When we put the word out that you would be joining us, we had a lot of people responding saying, excited to be hearing Logan's thoughts again. So welcome back, Logan.
Very excited to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here. I want to start off by talking a little bit about something that the way you challenge things. I mean, that for those that do not know you, and our audience has grown dramatically since you last spoke on the program, or a guest on the program, how did you get into this? You are not an economist. You're a loan originator. But you have your analysis is as thorough, complete, informed, and you put out as much information. I feel like I'm talking to someone with a PhD. How did you get here? Let's talk a little bit about that, just briefly.
I got into finance about 20 years ago. Before I actually started working full-time in the mortgage business, I got an interest in the stock market. So naturally, my kind of brain tendency is to track data. And, anybody who really wants to thrive in anything they do, they kind of fully engage in everything they want to learn about the job they're doing. So naturally, I became a data junkie. And in that process, you almost begin to almost train yourself just like how an economist would. If you track every single economic data point and want to learn about that. So when I started writing about housing economics, really, it was a financial website just wanted me to write some op-ed pieces. But I realized that
what's the name of that website?
Benzinga.com back in 2010. So then I decided just to, why don't I just create my own blog? And then I started writing articles each month. But then I went on Facebook, and basically what I do on Facebook is track and chart and put out every single economic data information you could possibly have, not only just in America, but out in the world as well.
Well, not only that, you've got some great pictures you put up from historical stuff. I love this stuff. And for those that are not connected to Logan on Facebook, how can they do so? I highly recommend
you
that.
You just go to Facebook and type in my name, Logan Motoshami. You know, we've got over 7,000 people there. And, yes, it's just it's if you like economics and, yeah, if you like historical photos as well, because I'm just a totally big nerd. So, yeah, that's pretty much what it is. There's no selfie
yeah,
there.
Really good.
Pretty much charts and historical photos.
Well, there's one selfie you did when you're on the treadmill working out, and it was the bookmark it. We're going to get to that in just a minute. There's a lot of – you're challenging, and I like, again, how you respectfully challenge many loud voices, big voices, respected voices. And it's not to take a shot at any of them. I love the fact how someone like yourself, Andy does this well, is you go out and challenge conventional wisdom, and you do it in such a way that – really gets people engaged. I mean, they don't know who you were. They try to Google you, and, well, what PhD, where did you graduate from, blah, blah, blah. And you just go at people, with not at them in a negative sense, in a respectful sense, but you go at facts and things that they're putting forth, and you challenge it. One of the things that's out there, I mean, Harry S. Dent is one of my favorite guys. Peter Schiff is another guy I've listened to. But Dent was, for the longest time, one of my favorite guys. He got it so right there initially with his first book that came out. He called things right, and many of us hooked on to, well, he must be right about all of it. But that's not the case. He's one of the perma bears out there that you talk about. But why did – so define what you mean by a perma bear. Who are they? What are those folks? And why did they get it so wrong?
Well, one of the things that's happened recently is that yellow journalism sells. And because of social media, because of the ability to people to basically give their own points of views, yellow journalism, people can just say whatever they want to believe, and there's a group of people that will always think America's horrible. There's some conspiracy on government data, and pretty much just lie consistently. Some people do it for vested belief. You know, some people have trades they want to push. Some people are just anti-American demagogues. They're just going to cry about America every single day. But one thing I've noticed is that if you follow economics, and I'm talking post-World War II, there's a certain trend that has to happen for a recession. And in 2014, I realized that most of these perma bears are just saying things because they know their followers just want to hear it. I'm not even sure if they even believe it. But because of their popularity is doom and gloom, they know that their vested followers have to hear them talk negatively. And then I thought to myself, you know, after 2014, we're going to start to go after these people. As much as I've been very critical of the housing bulls and these people who had high GDPs and high 10-year notes, yield. I thought it's time to kind of go reverse. And a lot of my economic stuff this year, what I write about, are actually more economic articles than they are just than housing. So it's right to go after both sides. And let's be honest, the perma bears, the people that have been calling for recession, crash, have had the worst 8 years post World War II. And you know, I'm going to tag a article to this interview with names, faces, and calls and data to prove that these people have no idea what they're talking about, and they know it. They just do it so people can clickbait their materials, because there's this group of people in this world who will only clickbait doom and gloom stuff.
Yeah, and salacious images draw people, get people negativity when you're out there putting that out there. It'll draw people. But
I wrote an article this year headlining, "The U.S. economy is about to crash." And in that article was every single data point to show that the perma bears were not only wrong, they were terribly wrong, but it was the most popular article I wrote only because of the headline. And I knew that the people would click on it thinking they were going to crash, but no, it was an April Fool's joke saying, no, you guys all got it wrong. Recessions are a function of an overinvestment thesis that creates a supply and demand imbalance that tends to happen when the Fed is raising rates to fight inflation. None of these things are present in the U.S. economy, and this is why the recession hasn't happened. And I don't even want to change the people's minds who listen to Harry Dent or Peter Schiff or Raoul Paul or you know, Mark Farber. I don't want to change minds. I just want to teach people that if you really want to look for recessions, there are just a few things that you have to see happen first before we even whisper the word recession.
Well, that's a great segue, and I'm going to toss the mic over to Andy Schell. Andy?
Yes. Hey, Logan, thanks for being on the show. Boy, there's so much to talk about. I love your website, too, by the way.
I've been noodling
around on loganmotoshami.com and clicking on some of your recent articles, including the housing bubble of 2016 and also the BritX article, which I think is really interesting. And including in the BritX article, you got a whole bunch of charts down at the bottom. I'm going into this level of detail because I want the listeners to follow with me. So when you get a chance, go to this website, go to that article, scroll down, and there's amazing charts that show trends and activity. I think the JOLTS report's a really interesting chart that you've put together that shows the trend of information. So the main topic I wanted to talk to you about over the next few minutes is what to look for in a recession, but I also want to tag on to that a comment from you about the impact of international negative interest rates on U.S. mortgage lending over the next several years. So I'm not sure where you want to start, but
In terms of a recession, we'll cut it down to two basically main points. Leading economic indicators have to fall at least 4 to 6 months, and unemployment claims have to rise, you know, from a low base. And we have our low, I mean, we are at 43-year lows in unemployment claims. If unemployment claims get to 323K on a four-week moving average, not a headline number, then we could start talking about, well, maybe the recession is happening because companies have to start laying people off because the demand isn't there and they're concerned about profit margins. None of that has ever happened in the last 8 years. We've had a downward spiral. In fact, the only thing that actually created a short blip in unemployment claims was the Sandy flood. The oil crash didn't really change the curve at all. The commodity crash didn't. We've had 17 international crises since 2011, China, Japan, Europe twice, Brazil, Russia. It doesn't matter. We are the United States of America. We have over 100 million workers that only work on domestic demand curve economics in a service sector society. On consumption, we're fine. We handled every single crisis, and it's been the most stable economy, actually the most stable U.S. economy in over the last 50 years.
Wow. So we're safe for a while because we haven't had that happen yet.
Inflation is rising. I think that's the thing that people need to start keeping an eye out. There is no deflation happening in America. Core inflation is rising. Headline inflation is going to start rising because oil has gone up. ECI wage inflation is at 3.6% year over year. For job switchers, which goes into the JOLTS data, it's at 4.3%, a cycle high, which is right where it was before the 2007 collapse happened. So wages are going up. Inflation is picking up. That's typically when the Fed starts to move. We're not there yet for them to move because negative rates, the entire world has demographic deflationary factors. And there's no inflation out there, and that is another factor on keeping, you know, our 10-year low, which is, if you look at my 2015 and 2016 prediction, there is a one handle always because inflation is not rampant anymore.
So do you think that the negative interest rates does that mean MBSs could come lower, and are we going to have another refi wave, or what's going to happen with housing?
I don't believe in a refi wave. If you look at total supply volume in 2012, that was the last time we had a mega refinance wave. And in that time, actually, you know, the only two times that we've had 10 years go to about the 130 level is both in European economic crisis issues. And both times we get there and we shoot right back up. I think the 160 level is really where the 10-year should be at. And we work off of that. But below that, you need some international crisis. And we're not there very long. For us to get another refi wave, we need to go below 1% and stay there for a few days to capture the real supply of people that can refinance. Because if you look at this year, even though the 10-year got to the lowest point of this cycle, we're slightly above 2015 levels in terms of refinance volume because we've been here before. In 2012, we were here. A lot of people have refinanced. Rates have to go lower to get a big kind of 2012 volume wave.
Hmm. Well, one other quick question, and then I'll throw it over to Joe. And that's this is a bit winging it, so these aren't prepared questions. In your article about BritX, there's the JOLTS report going back to 2000. And in that chart, it charts openings, hires, quits, the layoffs and stuff. And what I thought was interesting is that hires tend to be track correlated to but above job openings. So there's always hires are in excess of job openings. But now, since mid-2015, it's inverted. The job openings exceed the hires. And again, this is totally throwing it at you off the cuff. Does that give you any concern? Is that looks like
my biggest contention with people is that the great American lie was that 95 million Americans are out of work. That is completely untrue. We have a labor shortage today. Yes. The labor participation rate is, you know, being at 62% does not mean that millions of Americans are out of work. We're 8 years into the cycle. We have over 154 million working Americans. We're missing only 2.7 million prime age labor force Americans from the last cycle. And a good portion of those are women who have said they want to take care of their kids. It's not surprising that 2 months ago, at 5.84 million, was the highest job openings ever recorded in human history. And it's in every single sector in the U.S., construction, government jobs, manufacturing even. I wrote an article about robots aren't taking all the jobs, and I specifically outlined every job sector in America. We don't have the labor to fill in these jobs, and which makes sense because prime age labor force growth peaked in 2007 here, unlike the 1980s and 1990s. And right now we're too young and we're too old. That's going to change in a few years. The millennials are going to come into the workforce, and you're going to have more and more older Americans leaving. When they come in, we'll have the ability to fill in some of these jobs. But right now, everybody who's told you that 95 million Americans are out of work, unemployment claims being this low, it doesn't mean they're lying to you because they're anti-American demagogues, and they know that their listeners or whoever follows their work won't do the research to see, wait a second, this doesn't make sense. We only lost less than 15 million in the Great Recession. We're well over that in the jobs grid. How are 95 billion people out of work? Because it's not true.
So, yeah, you know, that's such a fascinating thing because I want to get into that, especially the comment their anti-American negative rhetoric. I'm wondering if it's even gets a little more political than that. I wonder if you're a Republican, you're looking at the numbers one way. If you're a Democrat, if a Democrat's in the White House, you're looking at the numbers another way. So I'm really interested in it, and I want to get into that in just a minute. But before we do, I want to toss the mic over to Joe and talk, get more a little more into the housing part of this thing. Joe?
Yeah. I mean, we've realized a tremendous improvement in housing and home prices, and got to be a lot of factors to that. Supply and demand certainly one of those, and low interest rates is one of those. And so, Logan, to what extent do you think that the housing price appreciation that we've seen here in 2016 is a concern, and what would cause it to be a concern?
Here's how I look at home prices in this cycle. Home prices are really a function of inventory because millions of people buy homes a year. That's never going to be a question in doubt. This housing cycle has had the worst demand curve for mortgage buyers we've ever seen, even at the lowest interest rates curve we've ever seen post-World War II. But it's shelter. People buy homes. Mortgage purchase application data is at the highest level in this cycle with nominal prices back up to the housing bubble years. Now, adjusting to inflation, home prices aren't back to where they were in 2006, but people are buying homes with mortgages at the highest level in a cycle with prices this high. I don't see that as a concern in terms of a housing bubble being formated, because a housing bubble or any kind of bubble to me needs speculation. In the housing bubble before, we had speculation on exotic debt that people could not actually afford the homes. And in 2003 to 2006, you see the data, we had mass cash-out booms. We had people buying homes with 0% down stated incomes. We don't have that. There's mortgage demand. It's not very strong. People are buying homes. It's the best home buying profile we'll ever see in this country, ever in any other cycle. These people have fixed low-cost rates against rising wages. The only way they'll lose a home is if they lost their job. And that's a function of inventory not being at 6 months or above 6 months, is because housing is very unaffordable. That's an issue. I don't think the affordability index that we all use from economists is a good one in this cycle, but I'm not concerned in terms of it creating a bubble top where people like Harry Dent are running around telling people prices are going to drop 40 to 67% in some areas. You need a recession. You need these homeowners to lose their jobs. One third of the homes in the cycle have been bought with cash that can't go into a distressed supply. So it's completely different from the last cycle to this cycle. We have the best home buyers in the cycle, and they are buying homes at the highest levels of the cycle with prices back at the nominal highs of 2006.
So, Logan, where do you see it going from here? I mean, that's where we've been.
Yeah, as long as inventory stays below 6 months, which I think is a function of an economic cycle, prices still have legs. Once you start getting a recession, people lose their jobs, they'll have to put their homes onto market. There's where you'll start to see a price decline, because we've never had, since 1996 when prices started to take off in this country, we've never had 6 months of inventory outside of the housing bust years. So I'm not in the camp that tells you low inventory is keeping home sales. I'm in the complete opposite camp. Demographics should have told you from 2007 that the housing demand curve is going to be soft from 2008 to 2019. There's no more exotic debt left, so whoever owns it can own it this time. And these people tend to be high income, high educated. You know, when people tell you that, Americans have too much debt. We have about $14.5 trillion of debt. We have over $102 trillion of financial assets over. This is kind of the best of the economic food chain. They'll be fine. If they lose their job, late cycle lending, low down payments, those are the people that you have to worry about, because those people have no equity to sell. They usually go into distress. It's back to a normal housing cycle, unlike, you know, 2003 to 2006. So the concern will be if, you know, prices keep on rising for some reason when inventory is higher. I don't think that'll be the case. It hasn't been the case for the last, you know, few years. Inventory has been below 6 months. That's the kind of level you need to see on a national basis.
Do you see the Fed playing a role in changing the direction of the housing market anytime soon?
I don't think the Fed has much power. The long end of the market has been, bond market has been going down since 1981. The Fed, some people can make the case that the Fed is maybe slightly behind the curve because inflation is rising and they're still at a quarter Fed funds rate. But, you know, you have $14 trillion of negative rates out there. The world economy can't handle a strong dollar. I mean, let's just face it. The dollar got stronger in 2014 to 2015. It sent a lot of these export countries into a recession. And, you know, negative rates are here to stay, and low rates are here to stay for decades to come. Unless you see inflation rising, because if you look at long-term rates and inflation, they move hand in hand. The best case for inflation is really when our young labor force, you know, in years 2020 to 2024 come into the marketplace. And because of that demand, they'll create inflation. So I don't see the Fed being that important, because they're really moving where inflation is. So I'm not in the camp that thinks the Fed can control the housing market.
All right, back to you, Dave.
All right, thank you, Joe. One of the things I want to talk a little bit more. I'm getting a lot of comments coming in to me about the labor participation rate and wage growth. There's a lot of us have locked in. Me too. I mean, I'll be honest. I look at the when you look at the unemployment, what's the number we track that's published all the time? Is it U3 or which one's that?
There's U3, but I think a lot of people are looking at the U6.
We're fixated
rate
on the U6, isn't it?
Yeah. So the U6 rate is at 9.8%. It's fallen down from, I think, a high. It's a little bit over 17%. So let's look at who's not working. Okay, so when we look at it, college-educated people are at about 2.4% unemployment rate. The recent college grads are about 4.1%. Who lost their jobs in the Great Recession outside of real estate and finance? Service sector jobs, high school dropouts, non-college-educated Americans. So a lot of these people are the people who aren't working. If you look at the data, which I don't think a lot of people do, it's a lot of high school dropouts. It's a lot of criminally active people who are not in jail. It's a lot of drug addicts who are not in rehab. And then it's the group that says, you know what, I'm taking care of my kids. I'm not working. We have no right to tell them to work. So that's really the function, because in this cycle, ages 17 to 29 are massive, and ages 49 to 65 are massive. Older people are working as a percentage at the highest levels we've ever seen. So it's not them. If they're leaving the workforce, the other ones are working. So when you count civilian labor force ages 16 to 65, do we really expect ages 16 to 24 to work full-time jobs, leave school? No. That's why the prime age labor force growth, which is running at 81%, that's the number people should focus on. It's missing 2.7 million people. Some of those people are on disability. Some of those people went back to school. Some of those people are home taking care of their children. And then there's a group of people which we as a country need to invest in. Our government does not invest in our people because federal debt is a political weapon. They tell you federal debt is bad. Federal debt will create inflation. Federal debt has been growing for many years, and inflation is at the lowest level. This is a political weapon, and it's starting to impact our economy because we don't want to invest because we, as Republicans or as Democrats, use federal debt as a weapon, and it's embarrassing. Our domestic investment from government in this cycle has been terrible. So,
that's a great segue right into where I want to go next. I mean, you look at the future housing interest rates, and we've got the Republican convention starting this week in Cleveland today. And then I would like to get your thoughts on a Trump presidency versus a Hillary Clinton presidency. Any insights? And I mean, just lay it out there. That's one thing I enjoy about you. And we may not agree on all the stuff and data points, but you always get me to think, though. And a lot of times I've come around going, you know what, Logan is right on this. So talk about what we can expect to hear. Or in a Trump presidency, one thing I would anticipate, he knows how to leverage things. All of his companies are highly leveraged. We're going to see American debt. Where you think Bush or Obama or anyone before him had a lot of debt, I think Trump would just skyrocket our debt. Your thoughts?
Well, here's the thing. Majority of the debt that's going to be created in this country comes from entitlements. Entitlements will not be touched by Trump. Trump knows this. Trump has actually gone against Republican principles that have been, you know, trying to keep federal debt and state debt down away. He doesn't care. If he actually knows his own budget, federal debt's going to blow up. And actually, I don't see that as a bad thing, because unless the debt actually creates inflation, which we are we have the dollar, we have the reserve currency, we have the biggest economy in the world, we have the strongest military in the world, we're going to be treated better than anybody on the bond market. So expect federal debt to blow up. I don't see it as a problem. I don't know if he's going to be able
to repeal.
What do
you expect that to happen?
Yeah, I expect that to happen with anybody, because I don't think either.
Yeah, either one of them.
Touch,
debt, yeah.
I mean, this is the honest truth. By year 2024, just the federal mandatory items, Social Security, Medicare, and net interest, that's going to take up all the government revenue based on a 3% GDP. Since it's mandatory, any recession that happens now until 2060 will just expand the federal debt higher. And I'm telling you, nothing's going to happen, because nothing's happened to Japan. We're never going to catch up to Japan's debt to GDP, and they're at negative rates. I mean, this has been a lie. I've been a registered conservative Republican. This has been a lie by our party for many decades, because federal debt is a weapon, a political weapon that you can use. And Japan is at negative rates, and they have the highest debt to GDP as anybody. So expect federal debt to rise from anybody, because I don't think anybody's going to raise taxes, certainly not in the middle class. Nobody's going to raise taxes in the middle class. I think that's one of the reasons why Bernie Sanders is not getting the nomination, because Democrats don't want payroll taxes to increase. Actually, Bernie Sanders was very admirable. He wants to pay for everything. I'm probably the left of Bernie Sanders in terms of free college education. You put $50 or $60 billion a year in the federal budget, it's nothing. You can do that without raising taxes, and nothing will happen. The world won't come to an end. I just don't think politicians want to risk that, because if they do, that means a lot of principles go out the door that they fought for 30, 40 years. So the debt has been growing. Interest rates are at all-time lows. Inflation is not, you know, present. Either Hillary or Trump, demographics are going to get better for the U.S. economy in the next cycle. But
yeah, it's fascinating. We are so out of time, it's not even funny. I love having you on. You do a great job each and every time you come on, and we love having you here. But as you hear the drums start playing in the background, it's signaling we are out of time and we got to wrap this up. For those that want to read more, be more familiar with you, Logan, again, what are the best places for them to go? Andy already brought up your website, Logan Motoshami. Maybe we should spell that for people. Logan, you want to give us a quick rundown of where people can hear more from you? Facebook?
Yes,
your website?
Logan Motoshami. Yeah, LoganMotoshami.com. And I will put an article with this interview with a lot of charts and data to go over kind of the things we've talked about.
I'll sign up on Facebook to listen to Logan. You're not going to be bored, I'll tell you that. I really have learned a lot from him. I love his attitude, and I just love you boldly going out and challenging people, boldly going out where no other people seem to want to go. You do it well. Good fashion. Thank you so much for being with us, Logan. Great to have you here. Also,
thank you,
betcha, friend. Also, thank you goes out to Joe Farr, Andy Schell, for being here with us, Sam Garcia. Appreciate everyone tuning in and telling others about this podcast. Have a great week, everybody. We'll be broadcasting next week live from the CMBA, the California Mortgage Bankers Association's Western Secondary Conference, and we'll be in the Arch MI booth. And our special guest will be Ralph DeFranco. He will be on with us, and he's the chief economist for Arch MI. Looking forward to hearing his comments on all of this. Talk to you soon. Have a great week, everybody. See you next week.
Thanks very much.
Let's hit the wrong one, looking for a short close. There we go. All right.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.